BBC Sounds. Music, radio, podcasts.
Hello, I'm Lauren Laverne, and this is the Desert Island Discs podcast. Every week, I ask my guests to choose the 8 tracks, book, and luxury they'd want to take with them if they were cast away to a desert island. And, for rights reasons, the music is shorter than the original broadcast. I hope you enjoy listening. My castaway this week is the actor Jamie Dornan. He was born in Hollywood, the Belfast one, but his career has taken him to the more famous one, first as an internationally successful model and then as one of the most in-demand actors of his generation. The model-turned-actor tag was, he says, a difficult one to shake at first, but he did it, with famously good humour and critically acclaimed performances, like his breakthrough role as the disturbingly charming serial killer in the BBC drama The Fall. Since then, he's earned rave reviews playing Kenneth Branagh's father in the film Belfast. Along the way, he fronted the billion-dollar franchise that was the 50 Shades of Grey series and starred in the hit television series The Tourist, which attracted millions of viewers and recently returned for its second season. He says, "There's no better high than reading a script and feeling that you're the only person who can bring it to life, but it goes with that constant babble with your inner self. After you've convinced yourself it has to be you, on day one, you're questioning why they haven't considered the other guy." Jamie Dornan, welcome to Desert Island Discs.
Thank you very much for having me.
So let's start with that challenge then of getting out of your head and into the role. There's a balance to strike for actors between the preparation and then the play, you know, getting ready for a part and then being spontaneous and open on set. How do you get that right? How do you strike that balance?
I probably don't get that right most of the time. I think you need a huge amount of confidence and self-belief to be an actor and to perform in front of anybody. And often I find actors are the most riddled with self-doubt and self-loathing. So I think there's always this aspect of having to overcome something, but not overcome it so much that you have total comfort. I think you need to always be slightly afraid when you step on a set. That discomfort can be when you're portraying an uncomfortable situation, but that discomfort can also be when you're portraying confidence. I'm probably most uncomfortable playing comfortable.
Can you give us an example of when you've, you know, when you've found that discomfort in a role and it's really worked for you?
Probably the opposite. You know, I have to say with The Fall, I felt uncomfortable with the idea of playing someone so heinous. But then once I realised that there was something that was working in what I was doing, I was able to kind of lean into it more, you know. So I find that very fascinating, that sort of trying to sell something that is so other to you and make it comfortable enough that it's you can believe it yourself then for people to believe it. It's very tricky water.
You said actors that you meet are very often riddled with self-doubt. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm going to have to ask you, are you?
Massively. Do you know what I mean? I'm pretty good at convincing myself and backing myself. Mm. And I do think that can get you pretty far. You know, I'm happier with my self-doubt because it always gives you something to try to prove.
Well, you have nothing to prove here on the island, Jamie. Let's get going with your music choices, shall we? What's disc number one?
If you're from where I'm from and you grew up in Belfast, whether you want it or not, Van Morrison is inserted into your soul at birth. I love him. I just love him. And I pick Caravan because I think it sort of encompasses the sort of joy of his music, the camaraderie and sort of family idea of his music. And love, God, he sings about love like no one else. Yeah, the caravan has all my friends. Yeah, they'll stay with me until the end. Gypsy Robin and Sweet Amber Rose.
Van Morrison and Caravan. So, Jamie Dornan, you were born in 1982 in Hollywood, County Down, just outside Belfast, the youngest of three kids. What are your memories of growing up there in the late 80s?
Extremely happy, but you cannot be from that part of the world and not be acutely affected, because it's almost like now I look back at what we took for granted as normal behaviour. You know, we'd sort of arranged to meet outside, you know, fast food chain on a Saturday after we finished rugby or whatever in town in Belfast, and it felt like every other Saturday there'd be a bomb scare and someone would call the house phone and say, look, there's a bomb scare, obviously we won't meet up today.
And what about for your parents? I mean, your dad had quite a prominent role, so...
Yeah, and where, you know, dad was an obstetrician gynaecologist based at the Royal Maternity, which is the epicentre of a lot of the madness, and dad delivered over 6,000 babies from both sides of the line. And I remember times, you know, when dad would go out and, you know, be checking under the car for bombs and doing it with him, thinking it was kind of fun, funny, or like a fun activity, sort of getting your hands and knees and look under the car. But then also, I remember dad got letters from, I can't name names here, but like from prominent figures from a loyalist community and prominent figures from Republican communities, both based on difficult pregnancies that someone close to them had and dad had sort of helped them through and everything. And basically sort of saying, from our side, it's all good. And then from our side, it's all good. Mad, like just mad, but comforting at the same time. And probably less checking under the car.
And your own dad, obviously, such a force for good, a positive force. Mm-hmm. Those 6,000 babies, mm-hmm. hopefully most of them still walking around out there. Do you ever meet them?
Are you kidding me? I think I've met all 6,000, honestly, at this stage. The amount of times people come up to me if I'm at home and I'm like, ah, oh, here we go. They'll say something nice about whatever film I've had just come out or whatever. They, can I just say? And I say, yeah, go. Oh, here we go. Your dad delivered me and my sister, and my mum always talks about how much she fancied your dad. I'm like, oh, listen, that's lovely. No, listen, it's been a lovely thing. And, you know, since we lost dad a couple of years back, it's a huge comfort.
Your mum, Lorna, was a nurse. Did they meet at work?
They did. They met. So now at the Royal Victoria Hospital, there is a giant car park. But back in the day, there was a outdoor swimming pool that was for the staff. And dad was in the pool and he saw a beautiful brunette climbing out of the pool. And that was my mother. And when the plans passed for the car park, they're about to fill in the swimming pool, and dad happened to be driving through the hospital and got out and in a very sort of dad kind of way went and sort of found the sort of head guy with a hard hat on and said, listen, what's the crack with the steps? He said, well, we're just gonna throw them out. He said, I'd love to keep the steps. So we had the steps propped up against a shed in our garden for years that Aww. He first saw my mum in.
Jamie, it's time for your second piece of music, disc number two. What have you got for us?
I get homesick for Ireland and Belfast and the people. So often when I'm away, I'll sort of find myself sort of Googling stuff. You know, I'll be on like local newspapers at home reading headlines and stuff. And I'd obviously like typed in Ulster somewhere. I'd written the words Ulster and came across this recording by the Ulster Orchestra of Philip Glass's Violin Concerto Second Movement. This is just one of those pieces of music that I instantly went, I'm going to be listening to this a lot in my life. And I do. I go to it all the time.
Thank you.
the second movement from Philip Glass's Violin Concerto No. 1, performed by Adele Anthony with the Ulster Orchestra, conducted by Takuo Yuasa. Jamie Dornan, I think an early dramatic highlight for you was a fairly spectacular performance as Widow Twankey in the school panto. You were 10, and how did you approach the role?
We had an amazing cleaner called Nellie Morgan, who was a formidable woman. Now, she lived in a place called Short Strand, a very infamous part of Belfast because it is a sort of nationalist Republican estate right on the edge of East, very predominantly loyalist part of East Belfast. It was a dangerous place. I don't think Nellie Morgan would have ever been scared in her life. She was just unbelievable, and she used to walk from there 6 miles to clean for us. And when you offered her a lift, if we were like, look, we're heading up the road to Belfast now, she'd usually say no. She was just brilliant. I just loved her. And I said, like, I'm playing Widow Twankey. And I'm going to steal some of your traits, basically. Anyway, a big regret is, and I don't know how or why it happened, but they're probably just very stingy on tickets, but she didn't come to see the performance. I think we did two performances of it. But I won the drama prize and I was very smug. I guess it was my first sense of getting a sense of satisfaction from performance.
By the time you started secondary school at Methodist College Belfast, rugby was a passion of yours. I wonder what you got out of drama that you didn't get from rugby. That must have been quite different worlds, quite different peer groups.
Yeah, big time. You know, rugby's a huge love of mine, but it's also a sort of boys club side to it, where it's like you're this kind of proper man, and
the kind of macho culture.
Yeah, and I'm fine with that, but I also think I knew that there was a side of me that was probably wanting to sort of skip about.
Be free.
Be a bit more free. And we had this drama studio at school, and you'd come off the hustle and bustle and the madness of the main corridor and go into these big, thick black doors, and you go into this space that was all black. Everything was black. It sounds really depressing, but it's like the most joyous space ever, because everyone just left their inhibitions at the door in the corridor, and you could muck about and play.
Jamie, it's time for your third piece of music today, disc number 3. What are we going to hear next, and why are you taking it to the island?
Sigur Rós are amazing, and 3 of my best friends and I went to Latitude Festival, and we started wandering our way down to the main stage where Sigur Rós were playing. I will say that we were sort of suitably influenced is probably about as good a way of saying the sort of our state that we were in. That sound they create is like nothing else, and it was just like flowing up this sort of bank to us, like it was penetrating us at the back of this bank. And with the 4 of us sort of looked at each other and went, let's just lie down right here. And Hopipula, I probably butchered that, literally started as our sort of bums hit the floor and we lay down, and we didn't speak to each other. Occasionally one of us would turn around and look at each other in the eyes. We were all just acutely aware of like how special this sort of moment was and that we were getting to share this together.
Sigur Rós and Hopipola. Jamie Dornan, when you were just 14, your mother Lorna was diagnosed with cancer and was told it was inoperable. It must have been an unimaginably difficult time for your family. You were so young. I wonder whether you knew how serious it was from the beginning.
I don't know if I know how I felt in a weird way, because it was such a... I would say I was a very young 14-year-old. I will never forget where I was. I'd just finished playing rugby, actually, at Purry Park, which is the playing fields of my old school, Methody. And I got in the car. And I knew Mum had been going in to the hospital that day for tests and stuff. But I didn't quite know what the crack was with any of us. And Dad told me there and then, before we even turned the engine on, that she wasn't going to survive. I think that was the only way he sort of really glad Dad told me that way. I don't think it would have been right to say, but okay, mm-hmm. we're all going to think positive thoughts and, you know, and we'll be praying every night. And, you know, we weren't a religious family by any stretch at all. So I'm sort of thankful that it was told to me straight like that. Yeah, it's a funny thing. Like, I wish, and I sometimes feel guilty saying this, but there's a lot that I don't remember about her.
Because you didn't know you had to. You were just being a kid.
I guess so. You're not expecting any of that to be taken away.
Yeah. What kind of support did the family give you after you lost your mum?
Amazing. Both my sisters are amazing, amazing people. Yeah, I definitely felt that. I felt that love and support. You know, my dad, I remember saying, you can't let this be the thing that defines us. And I really grateful for those words. And I,
what did they do for you?
I don't know. It was like trying to say that, like, you can live a fulfilled and positive and happy life still. Now, that doesn't lessen the impact of losing mum or anything, but I guess it was just to give us, Dad sort of giving us the okay that, like, it's okay to see happiness in your future. And the next summer, a very tragic thing happened in my life, and four of my mates were killed in a car crash. And in many ways, that was, had a bigger impact on me, whereas with mum, there's an inevitability about it. With the boys, it was just total shock and denial. Yeah, I remember distinctly thinking, like, going through all this now, this will probably toughen me up a fair bit, like, you know, when I get older, mm-hmm. because I haven't had a great couple of years with this stuff.
Jamie, let's have your next piece of music. It's your fourth choice today. What's it going to be?
I think I heard this song for the first time. In my head, it was like the first time my sisters and I and our dad were together since finding out that mum wasn't going to make it. And also in my head, we were sort of like sat around the record player as the song played. I remember just thinking, this has been written for us. And then subsequently, the same song then came on the radio one evening when I was driving around Belfast with Trev, who's one of my best mates. And we just looked at each other and started singing it, and it's really hard to sing. And we tried to stay in tune with the boys. I was sort of cry laughing my whole way through it. So it's sort of double meaning for me. This is Bridge Over Troubled Water by Simon and Garfunkel.
When you're weary, feeling small, when tears are in your eyes, I will dry them all. I'm on your side.
Simon and Garfunkel, Bridge Over Troubled Water. Jamie Dornan, you started a marketing degree at Teesside University in Middlesbrough in 2001, but you dropped out after your first year and went back home. Obviously, you'd been through a lot. What do you remember about that time?
I drank a lot. Mm. I was probably depressed, if I'm really honest with myself, and just clueless about what I wanted to do. I remember my dad just saying, just do something. You just got to do something. I don't care if you just go and, like, play golf every day, because at least it's productive. At least you're, like, trying to get better at golf. You're just doing nothing and I can't watch it.
So it was your sister Jess that put you up for a reality television show called Model Behaviour, and that followed would-be models. You didn't win, but you got an agent and started working with huge brands like Dior and Calvin Klein. What was it like seeing yourself on huge billboards?
Very strange. It's not something that I ever envisaged for myself, so it was very strange. I'll never forget the first time I was walking through New York, and I'd done this Calvin Klein campaign, and there's a massive, like, billboard with Natalia Vodianova. We're on this, like, black sand beach, and she's, like, pulled down my Calvin Klein jeans, and she's basically, like, taking a bite out of my arse or looking like she's about to do that.
Mm-hmm.
And I just looked up and saw it for the first time. And I was like, oh my God. And as I looked up, there's a woman beside me, went, that's disgusting. And I went, that's me. That's actually me. That's my bum and that's my face. But it was a very strange situation that I didn't seek out, but then it was very quite quickly good to me.
Mm-hmm.
People were getting in your ear saying, have you ever thought about acting? You'd be like, well, actually, I did.
My Widow Twankey was
excellent. I don't know if you heard about
excellent.
My Widow Twankey in 1992. I mean, I guess it helped that at that time I was, my profile as a model was big. There was a sort of want from that side. I felt like whether even I wanted it or not. And then slowly but surely I was convinced that I did want to do that.
Jamie, let's have some more music. Disc number 5. What are we going to hear next?
Maturi by Brendan Benson. In that summer that we're talking about, I drank a lot, as I said. I didn't achieve a lot. And my eldest sister, Lisa, had got me like a CD. And I think it was called Acoustic Volume 2. Right? And there'd obviously been an Acoustic Volume 1 that I'm not aware of. And although I was sort of quite rudderless, I was doing a lot of thinking. And often when I was doing my thinking, this album was on. I've always felt that it's like my little secret, this song. It's really strange. And it just takes me back to that time and those big decisions that were needing to be made so I could kick on with the rest of my life.
Met a girl, introduced myself, yeah. I asked her to go with me, but no one else.
She said, I'd really like to see you every day.
Brendan Benson and Metairie. Jamie Dornan, while you were modelling, you started auditioning for acting roles. How soon did things start happening for you?
I had had an agent for less than 24 hours and he sent me out in this audition for a movie called Marie Antoinette. Suddenly a day later, I was on a train to Paris and I auditioned for it there with a French casting director. And then that evening I sat in the Hemingway bar at the Ritz in Paris with Sofia Coppola having sort of martinis, and I was just really casual about the whole thing. And then when I sort of didn't, then when I was actively auditioning for like a good few years after and didn't get any work, and then I really realised like how good I had it at the beginning.
You had modelling to pay the bills, but do you think once you started pursuing it more actively that that model turned actor tag was a problem?
Not in the States. There'd be no change in their face if you said you'd modelled first.
What is it that about, do you think?
Am I allowed to say it's just sort of snobbery? I felt a great deal of that early on and it was a bit of an uphill battle.
And what gave you the self-belief to keep going and push through that?
I'm pretty determined person, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Again, I'm not sure if I hadn't experienced that loss and all that stuff we've already discussed. I'm not sure I would be that determined, but like something was lit under me at some stage.
So that tenacity paid off. In 2012, you auditioned for a part in a new BBC television drama called The Fall. It starred Gillian Anderson and was about a detective on the trail of a serial killer called Paul Spector. What do you remember about your audition?
I auditioned to play a police officer who dies in the second episode, which at the time I was like happy just to get in the room. Didn't hear anything. I was going out to LA for pilot season. Anyway, whilst I was out there, I was probably a week or 10 days into this trip, and I got a call from my agent saying, look, they want you to audition again for The Fall. It is for a different part. And I was like, oh, here we go. They said, no, it's for the main guy. I remember thinking, if I get this, this will change the course of my career. I was right. It did. It literally changed my career overnight.
Let's have some more music. Disc number 6, Jamie. What's it going to be?
I met Millie, Amelia Warner, in 2010 in LA at a house party. And I have this old Mercedes, this old 1988 Mercedes. It was the first car I ever bought with my first like good paycheck when I was like 22 or something. And I still have it today. It's beautiful. She's called Macy. And I had the roof down to Macy. We were driving along. And so I played her this song that I knew she wouldn't know by the Beach Boys. And I just watched her reaction. I was driving, so I was watching the road as well. I was sort of turning around to look at her reaction. And she was just instantly impacted by the song. It then seemed appropriate that it would be our first dance at our wedding. The opening line, if every word I said could make you laugh, I'd talk forever.
is pretty much exactly how I feel about my wife. Making her laugh is my favourite thing in the world to do. This is Forever by the Beach Boys.
If every word I said could make you laugh, I'd talk forever. I asked the sky just what we had, it shone forever. If the song I sing to you could...
The Beach Boys and Forever. Jamie Dornan, in 2015, you played Christian Grey in Sam Taylor Wood's film 50 Shades of Grey, which is based on the erotic novel by E.L. James. So you got the part just weeks before shooting was due to start in Vancouver after the actor who was originally cast pulled out. Your wife Millie, meanwhile, was heavily pregnant with your first child and the shoot was going to take several months. So you had a big decision about whether you should both go.
I'm amazed that Millie didn't just say no. Fair play there. What a unbelievable woman to hop on a private jet because we couldn't fly commercially with my dad on it, because if she went into labour in the sky, just, there needed to be an obstetrician, honestly. I mean, this is all serious. My dad had to come with us. And I'll never forget, we're somewhere over New York and my dad ordered a gin and tonic. And I was like, I don't know, Dad, like, you know, you're here, you're kind of at work here. Like, if Millie goes into labour, you need to... He was like, son, she wouldn't be going into active labour for at least, you know, 7 or 8 hours, by which time we'll be in Vancouver and it'll be handed over to someone else.
I love the image of your dad saying this with the gin and tonic in his hand.
Literally, it's unbelievable. And then Dulcy was born and 3 days later we started filming. It was mad.
The film was hugely popular with audiences, but not with the critics. How did you respond to, react to the negative reviews?
I think I hid. You know, I'm coming off the back of career-altering reviews for The Fall and BAFTA nominations and all this sort of madness that The Fall brought, to just ridicule, almost. Actually, we went down to Sam and Aaron, Sam Taylor Johnson and Aaron, her husband, their place, and they weren't there, and we sort of, they let us have their place in the country, and we sort of hid there for a while and just shut ourselves off from the world a bit. And then, so it came out the other side. I mean, it just made so much money. Like, it made so much money. So, like, 2 and 3 were, like, greenlit, like, overnight. So it's, like,
the box
a strange thing. Because then you're like, all right, there's a bit of ridicule here and I'm now contractually doing 2 more of them. And knowing that there'll be much more of that damnation to come.
Did you have mixed feelings? Any regrets about taking the role on at any point?
You know, I've just had very glowing reviews for recent work and there wouldn't be many of them that don't mention 50 Shades in them. You know, a lot of reviews are like, he's great, but lest we forget when he wasn't great here. Like, give us a chance. But no, regret that I did them? No.
Jamie, it's time for disc number 7. What's next?
Like, the Beatles are, they have been a constant in my life and I love still to this day hearing their influence on other bands that I like. This song just makes me feel happy and I think is one of the most beautiful songs ever written. This is Something by the Beatles.
Something in the way she moves attracts me like no other lover. Something in
Something by the Beatles. Jamie Dornan, we've talked a lot about your dad, Jim, today, and you lost him in 2021. He died of complications related to COVID, and like so many families during that terrible time, you'd been separated. You were in quarantine in Australia. You didn't get to say goodbye. That must have been so difficult.
Yeah, it was unimaginable. And then I had a job to start a few days later and couldn't really get out of that.
So that would have been The Tourist.
That was the first season of The Tourist. And I had to just stay out in Australia for, you know, we were there for 5 months. I didn't see my sisters or anything.
How were you going to work in the middle of all that?
Wasn't easy. I think I just had to
try to, you know, put the best version of yourself and create a really mad TV show.
And it was that same year you lost your dad. Belfast came out. You were playing Pa. It was set in your hometown. Mm-hmm. It was, the premiere must have been incredibly emotional for you.
Yeah, I think, you know, that it's almost like that movie is made for my dad. Like, my dad would have just loved that film so much. But I do take comfort in the fact that he knew that I did it.
Yeah.
And he'd actually heard of the actors I was acting with, which was rare for him. You know, some people, their dad will never tell them they love them, particularly to a son, or tell them that they're proud of them. And I don't think I ever had a you know, was ever with my dad or on the phone to my dad where he didn't tell me both of those things. So I feel like, you know, very fortunate there that we were all showered with love and pride from him for all of our lives.
Jamie, the time has come for me to send you off to the island. I'm about to do it. I wonder how you feel about the prospect.
I sort of would try to convince myself that I'm really capable in a situation like that. And I'd be like, oh yeah, what's this? I'm going to like build this class little hut out of wood that I find, and I'm going to chop that down. I'm going to catch that for my dinner and all this sort of stuff. But actually the reality is I'd be really clueless and I'd probably just sit in a ball crying until I died.
I mean, at least you've got your disc.
Yeah, I mean, that would keep me going for a while. I think what would happen is you'd actually get really bored of these 8 songs and then you'd really resent the fact you ever suggested them.
I don't know. You've got some classics here. I think you're going to be all right. Listen, and you've got one more to go.
Yes, I do.
One more disc before we cast you away, Jamie Dornan. What's it going to be?
I always loved this song. I loved how he was talking about someone who just sees the world differently and only sees the positive, and how we sort of, there's a necessity for people like that in your life to lift you up. And I think it's one of those songs that I was always sort of trying to work out, like, for me, who's this song about? And then it sort of took my dad dying for me to kind of realise that for me, that person who sees the world differently and was just always radiating positivity was him. And at Dad's memorial, which we had to wait a year and a half after he died to have, I made a speech, as did both my sisters. Part of my reading was reading lyrics from this song. This is The Hole of the Moon by the Waterboys.
The Hole of the Moon, the Waterboys. So, Jamie Dornan, it's time. I'm going to cast you away to the island. I will give you the Bible, the complete works of Shakespeare, and you can take one other book of your choice. What are you going for?
I'm going to take Where the Wild Things Are, because it's just so much of it is about, you know, the escapism and being on an island, and it is a book that I force on my kids the most, I'm going to say. Like, I'll play tricks where I'll be like, oh, I can only find Where the Wild Things Are. Like, no, 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 we read that last night. I'm like, I can only find Where the Wild Things Are. And the kids just love it. And I just love watching them love it.
It's yours. You can also have a luxury item. What have you gone for?
Could you give me a golf ball and a golf club? Am I allowed both of those?
Yeah.
Thank you.
And finally, which one track of the 8 that you've shared with us today would you rush to save from the waves?
Forever by the Beach Boys. That the one thing I'd really need to get me through is the thought of my wife and everything that she's given me and our family.
Jamie Dornan, thank you very much for letting us hear your Desert Island Discs.
Thank you so much. It's been very emotional. Thank you.
Hello, I hope you enjoyed my conversation with Jamie, and I hope he gets to perfect his golf on the island, although I'm a bit worried it might be a giant bunker. Oh well, we've cast away many actors, including Stephen Graham, Maxine Peake and David Harewood. Gillian Anderson, Jamie's co-star in The Fall, is in our back catalogue too. You can find all of these episodes in our Desert Island Discs programme archive and through BBC Sounds. The studio manager for today's programme was Jackie Marjoram. The assistant producer was Christine Pavlovsky, and the producer was Paula McGinley. The series editor is John Gowdy. Next time, my guest will be the photographer and writer, Val Wilmer. I do hope you'll join us.
Hello, I'm Dr. Michael Mosley, and in my BBC Radio 4 podcast, Just One Thing, I'm investigating some quick, simple, and surprising ways to improve your health and life. So which will you try? Maybe some green tea to boost your brain power. Time's up. Or doing the plank to lower your blood pressure. How about snacking smartly?
Delicious.
To benefit your heart health. So, to benefit your brain and body in ways you might not expect, here's just one thing you can do right now. Subscribe to the podcast on BBC Sounds.